Thank you for that introduction, and I generally appreciate one of the best introductions I've ever received, in fact. And now, let's get serious now, because our subject is a very serious subject, so we shouldn't be laughing. I was asked to speak by the committee on the subject of science and religion, and this is because I have absolutely no background, training, or knowledge in science, and only a little bit in religion. But I had spoken on this subject not too long ago in Murfreesboro, when they had an intensive program of growth there, and some of the members of the committee felt that this subject was so important that maybe we should bring it to the school. But I have decided to call the subject of my presentations this morning and tomorrow morning The Transformation of the World. This morning the title is called The Transformation of the World Part 1, and tomorrow it's going to be called The Transformation of the World Part 2. And I want to begin by talking about the principle of science and religion and how it relates to the transformation of the world. I like to always think of science and religion. I like to think of James Hutton. How many of you know James Hutton, who he was? Okay, he lived in the late 18th century, late 1700s, considered the father of geology, the father of modern geology. He was Scottish, and he would go out in the mountains and rock areas and kind of look at rocks, you know. And he noticed he could see strata of rocks. And then he realized that certain ones had worn away a certain amount. And he calculated how long it takes rocks to wear away. And then he looked at how far down they had gone. And he did his math, and he realized that the Earth was likely several million years older than we thought, even billion years or more older. And so he propounded the theory of what's called geologic time, or deep time. And he is now today still considered the father of modern geology. However, he was attacked immediately by the church. And the reason was, at that time, the church believed that the earth began in the year 4004 BC, on October 26th at 9 a.m. Now, you're laughing, but this is actually true. This is what they believed. They had somehow taken the book of Genesis and calculated the whatever they did. They came out with the exact time at which the earth was created, right down to the minute. And so he was rejected. And this was a very bitter time. And this was in the late 1700s. It was some 250 years earlier, as you all know, that Nicholas Copernicus, you know who he was? He propounded the theory first in Europe anyway. I mean, obviously the Greeks and others believed that the sun was the center of the universe, but for a long time the Roman world believed that the earth was the center of the universe. So he proposed that rather the sun was. They called this a heliocentric view, and of course he was named a heretic. Later on, Galileo developed his telescopes, and he absolutely proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that Copernicus was right. Galileo, of course, as you know, has been called the father of modern physics, the father of modern science, and various other terminologies. But in his lifetime, he only had one thing that he was called, and that was heretic. He was tried for heresy. He was tried for heresy because he proved Copernicus was correct. And at his trial, he made this statement, quote, "I do not feel obliged to believe that the same God who has endowed us with sense, reason, and intellect has intended us to forego their use." Isn't that a wonderful statement? And it did him no good. He lost, he was under house arrest, and he was forced to recant his belief in this. I mean, you force someone to recant a scientific belief, it seems so strange. And yet, this has been much of the history of science and religion, a very great unease, at least for the past 400 or 500 years. And we know it even still today. There is great disharmony between science and religion. Now, in 1912, Abdu'l-Bahá came to the United States. He traveled for 239 days, and he spoke on a number of subjects. He could have chosen anything to speak on out of all of Baha'u'llah's teachings, but he chose to focus on some principles and some teachings. And if you get that book, Promulgation of Universal Peace, you will find that he rarely failed to stress the importance of the harmony of science and religion. And if you read what he says about it, you'll find that there's far more to it than we first think. Because to him, the harmony of science and religion is essential to the evolution and development of humanity. It also has to do with the balance of the material and the spiritual in the life of both the individual and society. I'll read you a few things that he said in his talks in the United States in 1912. Quote, "If religious beliefs and opinions are found contrary to the standards of science, they are mere superstitions and imaginations. For the antithesis of knowledge is ignorance, and the child of ignorance is superstition. Unquestionably, there must be agreement between true religion and science. If a question be found contrary to reason, faith and belief in it are impossible, and there is no outcome but wavering and vacillation." In another talk, he said, "Religion and science are intertwined with each other and cannot be separated. There are two wings which humanity must fly. One wing is not enough. Every religion which does not concern itself with science is mere tradition, and that is not the essential. Therefore, science, education, and civilization are most important necessities for the full religious life." This is very interesting. He's a religious teacher, and he says that science is a necessity for the religious life. Not just be in harmony with it, but it's necessity. In another statement, this is a different talk, he says, "We may think of science as one wing and religion as the other. A bird needs two wings for flight. One alone would be useless. Any religion that contradicts science or that is opposed to it is only ignorance, for ignorance is the opposite of knowledge. Religion which consists only of rites and ceremonies, of prejudice, is not the truth. Let us earnestly endeavor to be the means of uniting religion and science." There are many other quotes. Actually, I have like seven more. But there's one that's interesting to me because it's almost as if it's a prophecy. It's a prophecy, what will happen to the world if we were to unite science and religion. He says, "When religion, shorn of its superstitions, traditions, and unintelligent dogmas, shows its conformity with science, then will there be a great unifying, cleansing force in the world, which will sweep before it all wars, disagreements, discords, and struggles, and then will mankind be united in the power of the love of God." So he's basically saying when science and religion are united, then the world will transform. Now, when I'm reading these quotes, I'm thinking to myself, well, why is it that religion has conflicted with science in the past, if what Aduha is saying is the case? And I can think of at least one or two reasons why, and I'm sure there are more. One of the reasons is that religion gets corrupted. Man-made doctrines infiltrate religion, and there is no true conflict between science and true religion. There's conflict between the man-made doctrines and religion. For example, we mentioned Copernicus and Galileo, and they were attacked by the Catholic Church because of the belief the Catholics believed that the Earth was the center of the universe. But there's nothing in the Bible that says this. They got this from Ptolemy. Ptolemy was a Roman, lived in Alexandria in the second century. As far as I know, he did not write the Bible or any of these things. But the church had adopted a man-made doctrine. And the adoption of man-made doctrines can lead to the disharmony of science and religion. Another reason why science and religion are in conflict is because religion has a problem with history and language. And I'm not talking now about Islam and the Baha'i faith. I'm talking about the older religions. They have a problem with language and history because their religious scriptures are written in a dead language and a culture that's no longer around. And it is very, very difficult to be sure what was really meant. When you translate from one language to another, it's difficult. It's even difficult in our own language to know surely what's going on. If someone were to take the writings of the United States and it was in 1920 or 1940 and they used a certain word in 1920 or 1960, it may be completely different. It's very difficult. Why would we base our entire belief that the earth, you know, was created, you know, in 6 days based on an understanding of a dead language? Let me tell you something. I don't even sometimes understand my own children when they come home. They come home and they'll say something, and I don't even know what that word means. And I live in the same country, speak the same language, and I live in the same family, and I can't even understand. And yet they are willing to stake their lives on the understanding of a dead language. So this is obviously a problem which they have. This problem is largely superseded by the newer revelations of Islam, the Bab, and the Baha'i Faith, because they're in living languages. But that has been a problem. It's just merely the problem of interpretation of dead languages. And I'm sure there's other reasons why, but we know that true religion does not conflict with science. So I thought about it and I said, well, really then religion and science are pretty much the same thing. In fact, if you look at it, sometimes religion acts like bad science. And sometimes science, unfortunately, acts more like a bad religion. You'll find many times science will reject something based on superstition as well. And if you look closely at the history of religion and the history of science, you'll see that there are a number of striking parallels. What are some of those parallels? Similarities. The first similarity is rejection. It seems that when religion first arrives, when revelation first occurs, it is normally rejected. And when great scientific discoveries are made, they are usually rejected, and usually rejected by the very scientists that should know better. For example, I was recently reading this interesting story of the 5 or 6 year period during which time the Wright brothers were considered fraud. And I say the 5 or 6 year period, the 5 or 6 year period after they flew at Kitty Hawk. Okay, now, I saw the movie. They flew at Kitty Hawk and the orchestra played and everybody was cheering. But apparently in real life, there was no orchestra at Kitty Hawk and nobody accepted them. And you can see that there's now infamous articles in Scientific American 2, 3, 4 years later saying how these Wright brothers are total frauds because we all know it's impossible for heavier than air vehicles to fly. It cannot be true because it's impossible. Science acting like bad religion in this case. And you go back the history of science and you'll find that rejection is a common feature of both science and religion. It seems that whenever there's advancement, there's rejection. It's also true that both science and religion are prone to arrogance. They're prone to arrogance. They tend to believe that what they have learned and what they've known is it. It's also true that both science and religion tend to believe that they have absolute truth. And in reality, neither science nor religion has absolute truth at no time. We know in the Baha'i Faith that Shoghi Effendi said this is one of the fundamental principles of religious revelation, that religious truth is never absolute. It's only relative to the needs of the age. And religion has trouble with this sometimes too, but we as Baha'is know that religious truth is not absolute. It can never be because there's too much truth. But science also tends to believe it has absolute truth. The irony is that today we know more about the world, more about chemistry, more about physics, more about cosmology, more about all of, we know more than we have ever known, and yet we realize how much we don't know. We realize how much we don't know in a more profound way. For example, scientists now believe that we know of about 4% of the universe, and 96% of it, we don't know where it is or what it is, but we know it's there, based on Newton's laws of gravity and how much mass needs to be out there. So we're only up to 4%, and yet we think we know so much. So both of them are not absolute, but both of them tend to believe they are absolute. Einstein once said that the most important thing in science is always to keep an open mind. I'm going to read you this quote. He says, "The most important thing in science is to not stop questioning. Curiosity has its own reason for existing. One cannot help but be in awe when he contemplates the mysteries of eternity, of life, of the marvelous structure of reality. It is enough if one tries merely to contemplate a little bit of this mystery each day, but never lose a holy curiosity." Okay, so there's three things now that seem to be parallel, similar between science and religion. One, rejection when it first comes. Two, they're both prone to arrogance. Three, neither of them are ever absolute. And the fourth is that they both appear to be cyclical. They both appear to not happen regularly, gradually, but rather there's a spurt, and then they live off that spurt for a long time, and then there's a long period in which it decays, and then there's another spurt. They go in cycles, like the sun, the moon, like the seasons, and so on. Both religion and science appear to be cyclical. And we know this, of course, as Baha'is. We understand that religion is cyclical. But the interesting thing is that the three greatest periods in recent history, and when I say recent, I mean the last 2,500-3,000 years. In other words, what we know as real recorded history, three of the greatest periods in which science flourished all coincidentally happened soon after the appearance of a manifestation of God. One was in the Greeks period, great efforts of a science, Pythagoras and so on, and we know that they got this knowledge from the Middle East, from the Jewish religion, from Moses. And Abdu'l-Bahá talks about this in Some Answered Questions. In fact, I studied in music Pythagoras. You know, how many of you know who Pythagoras is? I thought he was Greek. Did you think he was Greek? Yeah, that's what they told me, because Pythagoras was the founder of all music theory, so we study him a lot. No, he wasn't from mainland Greece. He was from the island of Samos, which is 4 miles from Asia Minor, the easternmost island in all of Greece. Where did he go to school and university? In Egypt. Okay. Comes back from Egypt with his university education, even Egyptian priesthood, comes back to the island of Samos, and yet we just forget this. And Abdu'l-Bahá says it's the same with many of the other Greek philosophers. They all went to Israel and so on, and they gained their knowledge. And there was a great flourishing of scientific knowledge as far as it could be at that time. Secondly, we find a great scientific growth following the appearance of Muhammad, a tremendous scientific growth. And even Western Europe and the Renaissance, there's not a historian, not even a Western historian, that will not admit that it was the knowledge that came from Islamic civilization, came through Moorish Spain and up. Some of the earliest popes, the ones that were doctors and scientists, you remember those words? They all studied in Spain, and they all got their knowledge from Muhammad. And the third period of scientific efflorescence happened mysteriously in the 19th century. And we all know what happened in the 19th century. The Bab and Baha'u'llah appeared, and science exploded. It absolutely exploded. Now, we may not realize the extent of what was discovered in the 19th century. As you know, in the early part of the century, the late 18th century, they finally figured out some of the workings of magnetism. And magnetism is a great mystery in the world, okay? And then they finally discovered the principles of electricity, the discovery of the electric circuit, for example, that electricity could flow and you could use it as opposed to just static electricity and so on. Then they started working on light, and it was Faraday in the early part of the century, and by the 1860s, 1870s, of course, it was Maxwell. And Maxwell basically united all of these three powers, magnetism, electricity, and light, and discovered what we now know as the electromagnetic spectrum. Now, the electromagnetic spectrum was that light is just a little tiny part of this vibrating spectrum. And all this rest we had never seen before the 1860s, 1870s. Well, of course we couldn't see it. Our eyes can only see visual light. How much of the electromagnetic spectrum can we see? Well, scientists tell us that if you take the electromagnetic spectrum and make it a film, or a 35-millimeter film, with each frame is like that, you could stretch the film all the way from Southern California to Alaska, and what we can see is one frame of that film. That's just a little bit south of Seattle, I've been told. Before the 1860s or 1870s, that's all we could see. And this much more was discovered. Can you imagine that? And almost every invention that came in the 19th and early 20th centuries was the result, or owed its origins to the understanding of electricity and magnetism, which ultimately became one force, electromagnetism and light and all of the other things. And from that then followed the understanding of atoms and the periodic table. You know, Mendeleev formulated the periodic table, and then the atom was ultimately defined by Niels Bohr, and then Einstein developed his theory of relativity, and so on. It is an amazing period of time. Abdu'l-Bahá says that more happened in that century in science than in 100 other centuries. In 100 other centuries. Some of the inventors that built on this were Nikola Tesla, Lord Kelvin, Alexander Graham Bell, Thomas Edison, Werner von Siemens, and so on. These people completely transformed our lives. And the life we live today is based on what they were able to take from these scientific discoveries. Now, this leads me to an understanding of the true significance of Rezvan. You know, Rezvan is when Baha'u'llah, he crossed the river on his way departing from Baghdad, and then spent 12 days, and on the first day he announced his mission as a manifestation of God. We celebrate this every year. We also form our local assemblies and so on. And most of us consider the significance of Rezvan in our celebrations to be to recount the story. We tell how Baha'u'llah went to the garden and the nightingales were there and the roses and the red roan stallion. Is that correct? That's what we think. But if you read what Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá said about the true meaning of Rezvan, it's quite different. We have three references that are interesting. We don't know exactly what Baha'u'llah said on that day because the actual declaration was not recorded. But we have three references to it. One is where Mirza Aka Jan, who was his secretary, wrote in response to some questions a list of the points that Baha'u'llah made in the Garden of Rezvan. We have that. We also have a tablet of Baha'u'llah in which he refers to it. And then we also have a letter from Abdu'l-Bahá in which someone wrote to Abdu'l-Bahá to comment on Rezvan. And I want to read all of those to you. Mirza Aka Jan, in his answer, when he was describing what Baha'u'llah said in Rezvan, listed that Baha'u'llah made three statements. I'm not going to tell you what the first two are, but here's the third. It says, the third statement on the first day of Rezvan was that the moment he uttered those words, all the names and attributes of God were fully manifested within all created things. By this, he implied the advent of a new day and the infusion of a fresh capacity into all beings. So the meaning of Rezvan is that religious revelation is a dual gift. It's the gift of revelation and the simultaneous infusion of capacity. And this is why we see this principle that science flourishes at the same time as revelation. Baha'u'llah himself, in the tablet, refers to this same concept that Rezvan was infusion. Speaking about his declaration, he said, "The divine springtime is come, O most exalted pen, for the festival of the All-Merciful is fast approaching. Bestir thyself and magnify before the entire creation the name of God and celebrate his praise in such wise that all created things may be made new." That all created things may be made new. On that day, Baha'u'llah made everything new. 1863, it was not just the gift of revelation, but it was the gift of recreation of the earth. As if God peels a layer of the onion away from the world and we can discover all of these sciences. Abdu'l-Bahá was written a letter by the believers prior to Rizwan, and they said, Abdu'l-Bahá, will you please send a message to the Baha'is because we're going to celebrate Rizwan. And he wrote a letter, and I'm going to read that to you because this will tell us very clearly what Abdu'l-Bahá thought Rizwan was all about. He says, quote, "Thou dost wish to celebrate the day of Rizwan with a feast, and to have those present on that day engage in reciting tablets with delight and joy. And thou didst request me to send thee a letter to be read on that day. This is my letter. O ye beloved, and ye handmaids of the merciful, this is the day when the day star of truth rose over the horizon of life, and its glory spread, and its brightness shone out with such power that it clove the dense and high-piled clouds and mounted the skies of the world in all its splendor. Hence do ye witness a new stirring throughout all created things. See how in this day the scope of sciences and arts hath widened out, and what wondrous technical advances have been made, and to what a high degree the mind's powers have increased, and what stupendous inventions have appeared. This age is indeed as 100 other ages. Should ye gather the yield of 100 ages and set that against the accumulated product of our times, the yield of this one era will prove greater than that of 100 gone before." I'm not going to read anymore, but you got the idea. They asked him to write about Rizwan, and he didn't write back and say, oh, that was when Baha'u'llah went across the river and all the nightingales sang and all the believers. He didn't. There's not a mention of that. That's not what his understanding of Rizwan is. His understanding of Rizwan was the infusion of capacity into the world simultaneously with the gift of revelation. That is the true meaning of Rizwan. Now, how many more quotes do I have on that subject? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. I have so many, but I'm not going to read them. I think we understand that this is a very important spiritual principle. Now, it makes perfect sense if we think what Abdu'l-Bahá said earlier this morning. He said that society cannot advance without science and religion being equally strong like two wings of a bird. So why would it not be that God would give us a new revelation and not also give us the capacity to discover new sciences? It would make no sense. It would be like giving us one wing of a bird. And we witness, all of us witness, the great infusion, the scientific spirit that came. Not everyone yet recognizes the gift of the other side. So, to summarize, it says, the appearance here of the manifestation of God brings two things, the gift of revelation and the infusion of capacity in the human race and the spirit of scientific discovery. Now, I want to now look at two principles that relate to science that are in the Baha'i Faith. Two principles that are so important that they give insight into almost every spiritual concept. And I call these the two great principles of physical creation. The two great principles of physical creation. And this concept is not spelled out precisely in the Baha'i writings, but these two principles are there, and I see them so often in the Baha'i writings that I am going to call it that. And these two principles are, number one, the physical world is not reality. That's the first principle, is that the physical world is not reality. The second principle is that the physical world is a symbolic representation of the spiritual world, which is reality. Okay, let's get those two very clear in our mind, and then we'll read some quotations from the writings that explain both. The first principle is that the physical world is not reality. The second is that the physical world is a symbolic representation of the spiritual world. Let's look at this first principle. The physical world is not the real world. The world that you are looking at now and the chair that you're touching and everything there that you're touching is not the real world. In fact, this is a concept that lies deep in Hinduism, it lies deep in Islam, it lies deep in Buddhism, the concept that there are two worlds and the physical one is not reality. In fact, there's an old statement, it comes from Islam, which is attributed to Muhammad. I have yet to find the reference, but I've heard many Muslims say it, and the statement is, this world is a dream. We awaken upon death. And it's a wonderful concept because every one of us knows the mysterious, strange feeling when you first wake up in the morning and you realize that you are only dreaming. Because while you're in the dream, it seems real, while you're in the dream. And then suddenly you say, oh, that was all a dream. And to imagine that Muhammad says that that's how you will see this life upon death is interesting. The fact that God gives you this experience some 365 days a year, all the days of your life, may be like a little reminder that perhaps there are realities other than this physical world. But we don't need just to discover that ourselves. Baha'u'llah told us this in the Seven Valleys. He says, one of the created phenomena is the dream. Behold how many secrets are deposited therein, how many wisdoms treasured up, how many worlds concealed. Observe how thou art asleep in a dwelling, and its doors are barred. On a sudden thou findest thyself in a far-off city, which thou enterest without moving thy feet or wearying thy body. Without using thine eyes, thou seest. Without taxing thine ears, thou hearest. Without a tongue, thou speakest. Now there are many wisdoms to ponder in the dream. What is this world, where without eye and ear and hand and tongue, a man puts all of these to use? Now, there are many statements in which Baha'u'llah says, this world is not reality. I'll read you a few of those. He says in Gleanings, the world is but a show, vain and empty, a mere nothing, bearing the semblance of reality. Verily I say, the world is like a vapor in the desert, which the thirsty dreameth to be water and striveth after it with all his might, until when he comes to find it, he findeth it to be mere illusion. The physical world is mere illusion. In the Hidden Words, Baha'u'llah says, didst thou behold immortal sovereignty, thou wouldst strive to pass from this fleeting world. But to conceal one from thee and to reveal the other is a mystery which none but the pure in heart can comprehend. Almost like a great shell game of God, in which he says there's two worlds and we show you one and we hide the other. And the reason we do this is a mystery which none but the pure in heart can comprehend. Are there any pure in heart here that comprehend this? Abdu'l-Bahá says, know ye that the world is even as a mirage rising over the sands, that the thirsty maketh for water. The wine of this world is but a vapor in the desert, its pity and compassion but toil and trouble. The repose it proffereth only weariness and sorrow. Abandon it to those who belong to it and turn your faces unto the kingdom of the Lord. You know how many I could read like this? I have a compilation at home. I think it's 10, 15 pages. I'll read one more, and then we'll go on. Abdu'l-Bahá says, life is of two kinds, that of the body and that of the spirit. The life of the body is material life, but the life of the spirit expresses the existence of the kingdom, which consists in receiving the Spirit of God and becoming vivified by the breath of the Holy Spirit. Although material life has existence, it is pure non-existence and absolute death for the holy saints. Kind of ironic, because although it has existence, it's really non-existence. He says, so man exists and this stone exists. But what a difference between the existence of man and that stone. Though the stone exists in relation to the existence of man, it is non-existent. I love the way Abdu'l-Bahá talks. Anyway, Do you get the idea? The physical world is not reality. Now, what is the second principle? It seems almost ironic, because the second principle is that the physical world is a symbolic representation of the spiritual world. Now you say, wait a moment, you just said that the physical world doesn't exist, that it's not reality, it's just an illusion. And now the second principle says that, on the other hand, we're saying that the physical world has great meaning. And yes, indeed, it does have great meaning. Its meaning is that it represents symbolically the spiritual world. There is a relationship in that one is a representation of the other. Think of it as a word. You know, Baha'u'llah calls this world the kingdom of names. You've heard that. Because what is a name? A name has no reality. A name represents something that is reality. It's just a symbol. That's what this physical world is. I'm going to read you two statements by Abdu'l-Bahá, but I warn you when I read them that they are from the book Baha'i Prayers 9, which, as many of you know, is a collection of pilgrims came back from Abdu'l-Bahá in 1900. So technically it's a pilgrim's note. It doesn't have the authority, but it's very interesting. It's supported by other quotes. I want to read to you what he said to the pilgrims in 1900. Abdu'l-Bahá was reported to have said, "Life is of two kinds, material and spiritual. If we wish to understand what the spiritual life is, we must look to the material world, which is an outward figure or symbol of the inward spiritual reality." See what he's saying there? If we want to understand the spiritual world, where do we look? We look into the physical world. In another statement, Abdu'l-Bahá said, "What time is it? Okay, I have to finish in 1 minute. Is that right? Is that right? What time do I have to finish?" And it's now... Oh, you know, my watch was upside down. I knew I was long-winded, but half an hour was ridiculous. Okay. I apologize. Okay. The scientific principle of putting your watch right side up. Okay. Here's what Abdu'l-Bahá says. He says, "Every material thing we see around us represents some spiritual idea." Now let's think about that very carefully. Every material thing we see represents some spiritual idea. As there is an outward material reality, so there is also an inward spiritual reality. Take, for example, the sun. There is the material sun, there is also the spiritual sun. As the physical sun rises and sets, so also does the spiritual sun. When the sun rises, the darkness vanishes. So when the sun of truth arises, all errors and ignorance disappear. And he goes on in this vein. So he says, everything in the physical world is a representation of the spiritual world. We have rivers, we have mountains, we have valleys, we have electricity, we have magnetism, we have... There are spiritual rivers, there are spiritual valleys, there's spiritual magnetism, and so on and so forth. This is what Abdu'l-Bahá is saying. This is from the Tablet of the Universe. Have any of you seen the Tablet of the Universe? It's been published several times. The Persians, of course, have it, and you've seen it. It's called the Law-e, if I pronounce it right, Aflakiye, is that correct? I'd love for a Persian to read it in Persian, because the translation we have now may not be the best. But it's fascinating. It's entirely on the subject of science and the universe. And he talks many times. It's a long tablet. I couldn't read it all now, even in the half an hour that I have remaining. But I'm going to read you a few statements from this Tablet of the Universe of Abdu'l-Bahá. He says, "From spiritual realities infer truths about the material world. For physical things are signs and imprints of spiritual things." I want to read that one more time. "For physical things are signs and imprints of spiritual things. Every lower thing is an image and counterpart of a higher thing. Nay, earthly and heavenly, material and spiritual, all of these are connected one with another and are interrelated in such a manner that you will find that drops are patterned after seas, and that atoms are structured after suns in the proportion to their capacity and potentialities. In another passage, he says, reflect upon the inner realities of the universe, the secret wisdoms involved, the enigmas, the interrelationships, the rules that govern all, for every part of the universe is connected with every other part by ties that are very powerful and admit of no imbalance. So from these statements, and I could read you plenty more, we realize that we can learn an enormous amount of spiritual truth by studying the world, by studying physics and chemistry and all the other sciences, because Adibaha says one is a mirror of the other. Now, fortunately, we don't have to do this all on our own, because the manifestation of God has, to a very great extent, mapped the physical world to the spiritual. Pick up a copy of Gleanings, pick up a copy of Hidden Words, and you'll find that almost every time Baha'u'llah refers to a spiritual concept, he uses a physical analogy. When he talks about unity, he'll talk about the light of unity. When he talks about God, he might call him the sun of truth. When he talks about the human heart, he talks about the soil or the garden of the human heart. He talks about rivers, he talks about oceans, he talks about mountains. And we can learn a lot. We can learn an enormous amount about these spiritual concepts by going to the science and understanding, as he said, the relationships in the physical world and relate that to the spiritual world. I recall I believe it was 1985 or 1986, I went to a Baha'i Studies conference in Toronto, Ontario. And I got there late, I mean, like a day or two late. It wasn't my fault, I had something to do, I just can't remember what it is. And when I got there, everyone was raving about this one talk that was like the best talk, and I missed it. And I heard it maybe 10 times. Oh, you should have heard that talk by Adib Taherzadeh on the human soul. And this was a very scholarly conference. They were professors and so on. And so I got this idea what the talk must have been like. And so finally I got a copy of it, transcription of it, and I read it. And I must say I was very surprised. I won't say disappointed, but surprised. Because rather than being a scholarly analysis of the human soul with, you know, going back to Plato and all the analysis and so on, all he did was take one analogy that Baha'u'llah had made, that the human soul is like the human embryo. That's all. And he spent virtually the entire talk going in detail, comparing the principles. Rather than making 100 points on 100 things, he very deeply went into just one analogy that Baha'u'llah gave. And yet all of these scholars said it was the most profound talk they'd ever seen. And I realized then and there that Baha'u'llah has mapped the physical world to the spiritual for us, and through science, we can greatly grasp spiritual truth by looking at these. But we sometimes tend to just pass them by. Baha'u'llah says, in the garden of thine heart, plant naught but the rose of love. And we say, ah, oh, that's just flowery language, and no pun intended. We think, ah, oh, it's just, but maybe, what is a garden, and what is it, and think about this. And you can meditate on this, and you can find that he does this. Now, how many times does Baha'u'llah map a physical thing to a spiritual concept? I tried to count in the last couple of months, and I gave up. I gave up. Just so much is going on there. The interesting thing is that once you start to think along these lines, you realize that the spiritual world becomes much more concrete, much more consequential, so to speak. You know, the physical world, we understand it's consequential. You do this, you do that, this happens. You pour that into a beaker, and you pour that into a beaker, and you die because it explodes, which happened to lots of scientists, by the way. You jump off a cliff, gravity takes over. We understand that science is consequential. But we seem to think that the spiritual world is some kind of vague, airy-fairy kind of thing. And yet we don't realize that the spiritual world is just as ordered and just as consequential. I'll read you a statement from Shoghi Effendi. He says, just as there are laws governing our physical lives, requiring that we must supply our bodies with certain foods, maintain them with a certain range of temperatures and so forth, if we wish to avoid physical disabilities, so also there are laws governing our spiritual lives. Just as there are laws in the physical world, there are laws in the spiritual world. These laws are revealed to mankind in each age by the manifestation of God, and obedience to them is of vital importance if each human being and mankind in general is to develop properly and harmoniously. Moreover, these various aspects are interdependent. If an individual violates a spiritual law for his own development, he will cause injury not only to himself, but to the society in which he lives. So, what are the two great principles of the physical world? One is that the physical world is not reality. The second is that the physical world is a symbolic representation of the spiritual world. And so the corollary from this is that we can learn spiritual truth by the study of scientific knowledge. This is one of the great reasons why we need harmony of science and religion. Some of us may have imagined that what Abdu'l-Bahá was meaning by the harmony of science and religion was that science needs to get religion. You know, you guys are materialistic, you need to get religion. But Abdu'l-Bahá equally meant that our religion must be more scientific. I mean, this is what two wings of a bird means. So I want to turn now my attention to applying this concept in the world, for what it means to us right now. Because I was asked to speak on the subject of how does the Baha'i faith meet the needs of today's age. And it can meet the needs of today's age if we can more fully grasp certain spiritual principles. And so for the remainder of the speech today and all tomorrow, I'm going to take spiritual teachings and map them to scientific principles. And we're going to see how this works. I'll use the actual analogies that Baha'u'llah or Abdu'l-Bahá used, and we'll explore them and see if it does not give us spiritual insight by looking at these things. But before we do that, before we look at it, we really need to understand what is wrong with us. Okay? There are really two things that are necessary for a doctor to cure a patient. There are two things necessary for a doctor to cure a patient. And remember, we're told that the manifestation of God is the divine physician. And what are the two things that the doctor must do? The doctor must first be able to diagnose what's wrong. He must know what's wrong with the patient. Otherwise, it doesn't matter what he does. The second thing is he must then know what is the remedy for that thing that's wrong. Without these two elements, medicine is also just a superstition. And we would also be stabbing in the dark if we try to apply certain spiritual principles to the world today if they're not exactly addressing what is wrong. And Baha'u'llah spoke about this concept very eloquently when he said, every age has its own needs. And then he says, be ye anxiously concerned with the needs of your own age. So we need to do that. Fortunately, we don't have to figure it out, because Shoghi Effendi came along and basically defined what are the ills of today and what are the solutions. There are many places where Shoghi Effendi identifies and lists what's wrong with the world. The list I want to choose is one that comes from page 124 of Citadel of Faith. I choose this one because it's addressed to the Baha'is of the United States. You'll find that certain lists that he'll send say, this is what's wrong with the world, this is wrong with the world, they're slightly different. They usually have two or three of the same elements, and then one or two might be different. But the list that he sends to the United States in, I think, was Citadel was 56, 57, can anyone remember? In other words, it's the last great long letter he wrote to America. He said there were four things, four things which are the ills of American society. And I believe there are ills in America at large, and there are ills in each and every one of our hearts, even as Baha'is, because none of us are completely free of these four ills. The first, he said, was a deterioration in the standard of morality. That's the first ill. Immorality. He refers it to the steady and alarming deterioration in the standard of morality. He lists five examples. He gives five examples. He says, as exemplified by. Now, before I tell you the five examples, I want you to imagine, what do you think would be the best five examples that Shoghi Effendi might give? Okay? You only could choose five. Surely there's 100 examples, but the Guardian only wants five. He doesn't want the book to go on forever. It's very near his passing, you know. So he's only going to list five. What are the five that he's going to do? Okay. He says these are exemplified by. Number one, he says, the appalling increase in crime. Number two, by political corruption in ever-widening and higher circles. I wouldn't have necessarily made that in my top five, maybe. Maybe top 15. Political corruption. By the loosening of the sacred ties of marriage. That's the third in his list. By the inordinate craving for pleasure and diversion. Okay, that's my number one. Yeah, okay. By the inordinate craving for pleasure and diversion. And here's the fifth one. Can anyone guess what the fifth one's going to be? You're not going to get it. By the marked and progressive slackening of parental control. That's his number five. And I see my daughters in the back there are nodding their head. Yes, thank you, Emily. Thank you very much. I'm sorry? That's Shoghi Effendi's example, five examples of the deteriorating standard of morality. So let's remember, because we're like doctors now, we're diagnosing what's wrong with us. What's the first thing that's wrong with us? The deteriorating standard of morality. Secondly, he says, parallel with this and pervading all departments of life is another evil. And that evil he defines as crass materialism. Crass materialism. And would you agree this is an evil too? And he gives examples of that. He says, crass materialism lays excessive and ever-increasing emphasis on material well-being, forgetful of those things of the spirit on which alone a sure and stable foundation can be laid for human society. It is this same cancerous materialism, born originally in Europe, carried to excess in North American continent, contaminating the Asiatic peoples and nations, spreading its ominous tentacles to the borders of Africa, and now invading its very heart, which Baha'u'llah unequivocally and emphatic language denounced in his writings, comparing it to a devouring flame and regarding it as the chief factor in precipitating the dire ordeals and world-shaking crises that must necessarily involve the burning of cities and the spread of consternation and terror. So what's number one? What's the first one? Immorality. What's the second? Crass materialism. I like crass. Crass materialism. I'm going to use crass from now on. Okay. The third one. The third ill that he says besets American society, I would not have got. I don't think I would have chosen it. But it's right there, page 124, Citadel of Faith. And he says, it's the darkening of the political horizon. Now, he's writing this in 1956, and he's explaining how America is caught up in this vortex of political, geopolitical affairs, and she will not be able to pull herself out of it. At the time, of course, it had to do with communism, Russia and so on. But we can see that this has not abated since he stated it. In fact, if anything, it has gotten worse. And we are caught up in this whole process, it is basically the crumbling of the old world order. And America, for some reason, is caught up in it. It's interesting because the first principle, one of the examples was political corruption. And the third principle is the darkening of the political horizon. It seems America has a little bit of problem with politics. Okay, just, you know, from what I'm reading here. So that's three out of the four. Three out of the four ills are what? Darkening of the political horizon. Who could guess what the fourth ill is? Just think. I'm sorry? Prejudice? More information, please. Racism, and racism towards the black, specifically. That prejudice. It's racism. This is one of the four biggies. I'm going to read to you the entire statement that Shoghi Effendi says, in which he says this is the fourth ill. He says, no less serious is the stress and strain imposed on the fabric of American society through the fundamental and persistent neglect. He says the fundamental, it's a fundamental neglect and it's a persistent neglect by the governed and the governors alike of the supreme and inescapable and urgent duty, the neglect of a duty, so repeatedly and graphically represented and stressed by Abdu'l-Bahá in his arraignment of the basic weaknesses of the social fabric of the nation. The neglect, he says, of remedying while there is yet time through a revolutionary change in the concept and attitude of the average white American towards his fellow Negro citizen. A situation which, if allowed to drift, will, in the words of Abdu'l-Bahá, cause the streets of American cities to run with blood. That's the fourth. So these are the four things that we should probably say we want to get rid of. Let's not make our own list. Let's let the doctor diagnose what's wrong with us. And let's not say this is what's wrong with them. Let's say this is what's wrong with me. And how can we get rid of these four ills? Because surely society will transform the quickest if we take the remedy for the ills that are really besetting us. And so we want to find what are the principles, what are the scientific principles that we can apply, and what are the spiritual principles that we can apply to resolve these four. So what I plan to do tomorrow is to look at certain spiritual principles I find in the writings and relate them to scientific concepts and see how they can address these four ills. And so that I will leave you, because I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to say tomorrow, okay? But believe me, it'll be a whole lot better than what I said just now, because basically all I wanted to do now was to introduce the concept. Tomorrow I want to apply the concept, if that makes any sense. So that's the end of my talk, and believe it or not, this is an historic occasion. I have actually finished less time than I had allotted, because I got scared at first. So if anybody wants to ask any question, maybe one or two, and then we're going to go right on it. If Jack McCants is he here? I'm sure he's here, right? Is Jack here? Okay, Jack is not here. Okay, so if anyone wants to ask any questions or make any comments, you're more than welcome. Yes.